May it please the court, my name is James Ilovich. I'm representing Tina Tolley, who is the appellant in this matter. I'll forego, I guess, a recitation of facts and address them as I'm discussing the principles under Virginia's 63.1202 and 1205. But I will tell the court at the outset, I am aware of the legal standard that the appellant has to overcome in this case. In other words, the trial court is presumed to have settled all matters of fact, and that this court will not disturb the trial court's opinion unless it finds that the court is wrong or without evidence to support it. When we're dealing with termination cases, all of these cases start the same way, the published cases, that the courts, the statutes, and anyone who interprets the statute should presume that the primacy of the parental-child relationship should be preserved if at all possible. And then they'll go on through 3, 4, 5, 10 pages, depending on the particular case, to find, in most cases, a reason to affirm the trial court's termination of parental rights. In this case, the trial judge was presented with evidence that a child was born in 2010. The child resided jointly with the appellant, the appellee, Terry, for about 3 years. Mom lived in aunt's home, and at some time in 2014, April 2013, there was a petition filed for joint legal custody. There is no transcript in this case. There was a fax provided, so that the actual questions asked and answered are not available to us, but it's clear that from the order of that court, and I guess some discussion about that in trial, that there was a decision made based on mother's perceived mental health conditions, her ability to care for the child at that time, that there would be a custody order of joint legal custody with primary physical custody to the appellee, Terry. I think it's important to note, though, at that time, at least 3 years into the child's life, though there are some issues noted with mom's parenting, she is still left in a capacity to have joint legal custody, which means that she could and would be called upon to make legal decisions. She could make those decisions by herself, such as for medical or schooling. So apparently none of the parties at that time thought that she was not able to act in that role. Her mother did state in a hearing, and there's a document attached to the order of that time, that she thought her daughter wasn't spending a lot of time with the child. But again, she maintained that legal custodian access to the child. It's clear, again, not necessarily from...
I hate to interrupt you because sure. Your time goes by. So
oh, dear. Please go.
And everything you say certainly seems to be correct, but once the assault occurred with the stabbing of the aunt who was looking after her child, why doesn't that just change everything?
Well, I guess I don't want to take that in a vacuum, and I agree that it's certainly a factor that the trial court absolutely considered because he refers to it in his opinion. It's a huge factor in the case, but because a result of that incident, not only is the mother arrested and incarcerated, which doesn't allow her the ability to see the child, but also there's follow-on testimony from experts that incident did have a serious detrimental mental health effect on the child.
Because there was a finding of fact made that it occurred in the presence of the child.
That's correct. But leading up to that, there were a series of protective orders. And even though they had this, the nature of the legal, joint legal, primary physical custody, that order did not change. But the appellee, the aunt, began to seek protective orders. She sought one in September of 2013. She sought another in December of 2013. And then a third in February of 2014. And finally, the third one, we can infer from that Ms. Tolley, the mother, continued to have contact with the child because in that order she said that she was now including the child because of what she perceived to be violent conduct, shaking the child, I think specifically what she said in that case. So that child was included in that for a one-year removal, essentially, from her not able to have contact with her, with the exception of one visit, which was in March, and then a few days after that, this incident occurred. Now, I guess getting to your main point, is that a showstopper? I would ask the court, I guess up to this point, I think the trial court has to, and this court has to consider what the trial court considered about the quality of the relationship. It wasn't a perfect parental relationship, obviously, but other than one incident of what the aunt said was shaking the child, there's no other indications of abuse or neglect by the mother against the child. What is clear is there was a deteriorating relationship between the appellant and the appellee. What is clear is that through court process, legal and lawful court process, the aunt then kind of forestalled her ability to see the child. And that is a factor that for the trial court to consider. Was she thwarted somehow in her ability to parent?
Doesn't the trial court also consider the lengths to which mother is willing to go to exact her revenge on this relative in the presence of her own child?
In a vacuum, I guess, of course, but in this case, we also have the issue of mother's mental health. One of the reasons that they even entered into the joint legal custodian relationship is because all parties agreed that, and they discussed, she has a violent tendencies. The mother indicated she wanted her mother, the appellant's mother indicated she wanted her to take her medication. She was concerned about that. So all parties were aware of these.
Just further reasons as to why trial court Judge Ellis did the correct thing.
To say that, I guess, without at least looking at everything that happened, then obviously the policy concerns would be that every time there's a mental health component to a case.
But that's not what I said. I mean, here you have a stabbing that happened in front of the child, in front of other children as well who were guests there, and she snuck up on her to do it. So that, and then even after she's gravely wounded, she continues the assault and follows her into the house, into the kitchen. I mean, it is just the totality of the circumstances would seem to be much more than, well, there's a mental health issue here.
I don't mean to sound facetious, but it is a bad incident, but it is a single incident. In other words, you know, if all the things you just described had occurred over a period of a year or 18 months, then there might be there would obviously be a pattern of violence.
Well, you have to add the shaking of the child to that. And then you have to look at your client's jailhouse letters, her artwork, and the threats contained in those letters to not only two adults, but also a child.
She did after she was arrested and held, no doubt. She sent letters that were entered into evidence. They were mostly angry, as I recall, towards the birth father. And obviously it's conduct
in his wife or his new significant other, the threats towards her and her life, and their child. It was also a threat on the life of the child.
Miss Tolly has mental health issues, and Miss Tolly has anger issues. And if that is enough, then of course, Judge Ellis did not err.
I'd like to back up a little bit to the legal framework that we're viewing this in. The U.S. Supreme Court Troxel said that you couldn't terminate parental rights just solely based on the best interest of the child, that it required some type of showing of unfitness. And the Virginia Supreme Court later used the language in our statute, I think it's called to the detriment of the child, to be the functional equivalent of unfitness of the parent. The General Assembly then amended the statute significantly, removed detriment of the child, and said the court solely shall consider, well, not solely, consider the best interest of the child.
Right.
And then it included a bunch of relevant factors, some of which deal with the parental unfitness, many of which don't.
Yes, sir.
So I guess my question is this. In this particular case, is it necessary for the trial court to find anything other than it's in the best interest of the child to terminate parental rights?
Well, as you said, Your Honor, when the court revised the statute, I think it put in its place, because it did that, it put in its place that the court had to then have a framework for it to consider. And our argument would be that for many of those factors, Those things could have gone in favor of the appellant. And if you don't mind, I ask to reserve 5 minutes. May I reserve 4 minutes?
That's fine.
Thank you. Birth parent's efforts to obtain or maintain legal or physical custody of the child. Obviously, Ms. Tolley remained part of the child's life. She would attend these court functions. And then, of course, by the time of termination, she absolutely wanted to be a party to maintain the relationship.
But she was unable to assume full custody of the child.
Right, but as the appellate courts have said, she was unable at that point because she was incarcerated, and incarceration alone is not a fact that would constitute without just cause.
But that is one of the factors. I think that's in the termination of parental rights context, not in the adoption against the wishes of the child, against the wishes of the parent. The statute that was adopted, that the Supreme Court discussed in Copeland, that is one of the factors, that the birth parents are currently unwilling and unable to assume full custody of the child.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think it seemed like in the letter opinion that Judge Ellis did make that, and again, it's like an 800-pound gorilla. You can't ignore the fact of what she did and the result of that. But our argument would be that that's not the only thing to consider in this case, especially in a family context. And if I can, I'll stop here and I can take that out of the account. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. I'm Carolyn Seckley, and I'm representing the appellee, Terry Tolley, in this matter. I will tell the Court that the Copeland case and the elements that are set forth in the statute are very relevant. All of them are very relevant in this case. I think that what Mr. Ilovich is arguing about is the relationship between the parent and the child, which is one of the factors for the court to consider, but there are other factors as well. And I think the trial court was accurate in going through each one of those factors and making specific factual findings that favor.
Does the trial court need to address each of those factors? Because I think the statute said including but not limited to.
Correct. I believe that Judge Ellis was very thorough in going through what was set out in that statute. I can say that in the month that we had this case, this court sent a case of adoption back to the Spotsylvania court for the court to make specific findings, which is actually what Judge Ellis did. I don't know that we had that case yet, but it's actually what he did in this case. There's a little bit of a different view, I believe, that the court shared with my client as far as the history of the parties and the relationship with the child. My client was the relative of the mother of this child. She's her maternal aunt. For years, she had custody of her and dealt with her mental health issues. The evidence in this case was about extreme efforts that she made to maintain the relationship between the child and the mother, which ultimately resulted in the assault that then resulted in the mother being incarcerated. So in not just protective orders trying to keep her away, but there is a history in this case of efforts that she made actually to try to keep these children together, which resulted in her almost dying. So I think the analysis that the court made was proper. The evidence was very compelling and overwhelming, and although Mr. Ilovich's client did testify that she had a good relationship with the child, there was absolutely no evidence of that, and the court makes that finding in its letter opinion. I think the court made the appropriate ruling in this case, even on alternative grounds as well, that neither of these parents, the father, had never met the child and had no interest in meeting the child during the pendency of this case, which was for a couple of years. And the mother clearly had had no contact with the child, not because of the actions of the custodian, but because of the actions of the courts. Any questions?
I don't have any further questions.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Yao, is there any comment or anything you want to make to the court? We appreciate your service as guardian ad litem.
I don't think there's anything I need to add.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Yao. And Mr. Elijovich, you have your rebuttal time.
May I have another time, too?
I'm sorry, what?
courts, I've sat and watched several of the criminal cases going on today. I do a lot of criminal work. When I read these line of cases, it reminds me of very much in the way that they're structured and the findings usually of other crimes evidence. Almost every one of those cases starts with, everybody knows that the evidence of other crimes will not be admitted unless. And these cases sort of start the same way. Everybody knows that there's a primacy in the parental-child relationship, all the way from the Supreme Court in Santofsky v. Kramer, all the way down. And then the case starts to break down into the unlesses. The one difference, though, is it seems like in the criminal context of those, they always are going back and sort of weighing what they're doing against that initial concept that other crimes should not be allowed in, and then they look for other reasons. It seems like in these cases, there's an acknowledgement of the parental primacy, and then the rest of the analysis is about why it has failed in this case, and never going back to, has it been enough to get to overcome that? Now, best interest of the child is the standard. And the trial court is allowed to apply that. But our argument would be in a case such as this, there is obviously a difference in between the takings type cases or the termination of parental rights cases that come from DSS, and then between the family adoption type cases like such as we're dealing with here. But I think that some of those become more pronounced in favor of the parent. In other words, in this case, you have a maternal aunt. What actually changes in the situation that they had to set maybe after the incident to go in and clean that up a little bit and give mom no contact or anything like that without the termination of parental rights? In this case, this child knew who her birth mother was. They did have a relationship. They had had visitation. So it's not like by erasing her, by terminating her parental rights, suddenly that child will not know who the mother is. So that. And then the child stays in the same place. That's always a concern that there's an ability for the child to have the regularity that's always sought for children. Nothing would have changed in this case. The terminations in these instances sometimes seem punitive, and in this case, I think there are factors the court could have and should have considered because of the appellee's conduct, and what she did leading up to the assault. Yes, she may have been dealing with her mental health issues, but at some point she began to just not want to deal with her at all, and making that more difficult. There seems to be, there seems to be a progression almost in this case where the appellant, Terry Tina, became more upset, more troubled, and it just almost like it just kept rolling and rolling to its horrible conclusion when she assaulted her. This issue about
protective orders, yeah, there were.
Three separate protective orders sought, and she violated, the last one was in place, and she violated at the time of the assault. It was a one-year protective order, though. She would not have been able, except for that March 1st date, to see that child for a year. And our argument would be, of course, that the court, I think, failed by not looking at that in the totality. He judge, in his opinion, rightfully lauds the efforts of the appellee in this case and what she's done. But it seems like sometimes these cases sort of break down to the good guy, bad guy analysis. Terry, the appellant, has done everything right. Terry, the appellee, has done everything right. Tina, the appellant, has not. And because she did not, because she failed in certain areas, her parental rights are terminated. The factors in place are not immediate. They're not like time sensitive, such as like removing children from foster care. Again, if preserving the family is paramount, and not just the parental family unit, but in this case, there's evidence of her mother, other sisters. There's this large family unit that had contact with both parties at one time, had contact with this child, and would have been available. The extreme measure of terminating parental rights, again, there's two code sections that drive it. The court found it to be in the best interest of the child because of everything that had gone on before, but our argument would be the everything involves that incident, and from that, basically found under 205 and 202, I'm sorry, 1205 and 1202, that the court had sufficient evidence to terminate parental rights or had the facts to fit that with the termination process. We would argue that was error. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lidgeville. We will greet counsel.